Welcome to Have You Heard, where we talk about issues at the intersection of agriculture and engineering. Let's get started. Here are your hosts, Morgan Hayes and Josh Jackson.
Welcome. This is the Have You Heard podcast. This is episode 79. Four really useful, unexpectedly.
Yes.
I'm Morgan Hayes, an assistant of system Kentucky, focusing on livestock, personal life, farm in Boyle County.
I'm Josh Jackson, president of Biosystem Agriculture Engineering. Well, I focus on precision livestock farming, personal life, raised cattle, focus on some hay production.
So let's do a quick update because we're here in sort of late spring, almost into summer now, it feels like. Things are happening on the farm. So we're no longer in the we're feeding hay every week. We're into the lots more happening.
So we went ahead and we rotated a group of cows, and so we had them on some pasture ground that we fertilized. It looked really good. We actually probably could have cut, you know, that's one place we probably could have cut for hay. You guys cut hay. We had a field that was fertilized early March, so it was actually, we put the cows out there, and they're taking it down fairly well. So I think we got maybe 3 weeks to a month, depending on how. And so we have to move those cows. We also clean out one of the barns, getting some ready to put the sheep in there. Just that's where our cattle usually are whenever we're working them. So it had gotten built up over the years. Finally cleaned that out. Got a fair number of loads. Yeah, very surprisingly.
Nice. Spread that on the fields, get some nutrients.
And then spread some additional manure as well from the other feeding barn. So kind of manure weekend, and then like other odd jobs. And they're still taking out fence. So thinking about trying to put it back in.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big process. And you guys are looking into issues here. He definitely well. So our primary thing that happened in the about 14 acres.
Okay.
One of our higher quality orchard clover field.
Okay.
Honestly, it was a little bit thin because it's today is actually May 1st, but this hay got done well before. So worth.
Okay.
So definitely early for us, probably 2 to 3 weeks ahead of where we typically are on thing.
But
we were getting some, I mean, the orchard grass was heading out. It was time to cut it from a quality perspective. It got cut, got some rolls, we put them in the barn before this rain came through. We then turned around. £120 get down acre, so a little over 50 pounds. Trying to keep pushing it along. And we ended up topping up the buggy. It was a little bit more above and pasture ground. First field of grazing, they were rotating off of it, so we were right behind. Threw a little bit of nitrogen right where they just grazed, and which I am kind of shocked that we have not only gotten hay cut, but we've also started bush hogging. The thought being that this grass is a little bit ahead of them. This is the last one we rotated them on. And what we don't want is weeds, where there were spots that they left high, that they weren't so interested in. Cut that down, let the grass really jump for uniform. Maybe even more efficient.
Right, and so you put down the fertilizer. So you're planning to get maybe 4 cuts this year? Is that crazy talk?
We've never gotten 4 cuts, but I think there's a legitimate chance that the reason to push it is to try and get a 6-week cut. The next 6 weeks, another cut, which mid to late June. Ideally, what will happen is we will do our whole first cut, and we'll finish our first cut. We will come right back in and the back end of the first cut. Our goal is always to have first cutting done June before July 1st. That's still our goal. We'll see how the weather cooperates, but it looks like we're going to have rain for a couple weeks here. When that ends, if we have an open window, we are now in a position to hit hard on bigger pieces of ground. This field is a challenge because it's towards the back of one of the farms. Move equipment from there to the next spot that we cut in quality. Our cycle is to cut highest quality grasses first and then work our way down. If we have to run from this backfield to the next field, if we have like a 4-day window, we lose a few hours in the process of moving equipment. So having this out of the way makes the whole process a lot easier.
Huh. And then I guess in July will come in. Hopefully July, the clover starts really kicking in. Harvest that late July, early August.
Exactly. Yeah, that would be the...
Then possibly get another cut after that, depending on what everything does.
Yeah, the third cutting will be kind of dicey. Like, ideally, it'd be 6 weeks, but I think realistically, the way summers tend to go around here, I'm guessing it's going to be like an 8-week cycle just because both the clover and the orchard will slow down. So probably an 8-week cycle, probably putting us in mid-August. That will make the last cutting a little late. But the other option is if it's not really appropriate to cut a fourth, we might still be able to graze it.
Okay.
I don't love grazing that field just from management standpoint. We'll figure that's the most efficient. Oh, massive.
Yep. I mean, the past couple of years have pretty much shown us that you get pretty dry about August, September. So sometimes we have to go with plan B.
Absolutely. So at least we're in a position to get three cuttings even if it is a drier. So we'll see what happens here. But it's already jumped out of the ground. I did manage when we've talked before in the frustration buggy, but I managed the universal right behind the oak on busted out. I mean, just I actually did not hear it, so I'm not sure how catastrophically it failed without me noticing the sound of it. But it was gone, and I looked back and I was like, well, there's only half of a PTO shaft, and it's not attached to the. It's not attached to the tractor, so I've yet to find the actual shaft that I lost. Wow. My husband spent an hour the night that I lost it, and then I spent another hour last night for it, and I don't think I'm going to do a full grid pattern over the whole place only from a pull the grass standpoint, but I am a little bit nervous that we're going to find it on our next cutting. So when we get to the next cutting of hay there, just ask me if I ever found
that
a PTO shaft.
I'm surprised, you know, you think it would have left a line almost.
Well, what ends up happening is the part of the shaft that was still attached to the buggy, which is the wider part of the shaft.
Yeah.
It falls down and it ended up landing on top of the frame that pulls the buggy.
Okay.
So it didn't actually fall to the ground. That part of the PTO isn't long enough to hit the ground.
Oh.
If the other part had been attached at the PTO, at the yoke and the universal there, if it had just fallen apart, that part would have hit the ground.
Okay.
But in fact, that part was not.
I was thinking we left a line of like the fertilizer.
Oh, we did leave a line of the fertilizer, but then it rained the day.
Oh.
That evening. So it rained that evening. My husband went back and looked for it. I had to do other tasks that evening. So he drove around looking for it, but couldn't find it. He could see where I had clearly driven along, not noticing that I... judgment from the audience is acceptable here, because I'm a little embarrassed that I did not realize that.
I'm not going to throw fault at you, because I too, when you're driving the buggy, I was like, this should work.
And well, you're driving and, like it and should it's work. Not, it's not, it's already makes a lot of weird noises, a buggy.
Yeah.
And the PTO was still running. And nothing was hitting. Like, normally, if something sort of falls apart, something hits somewhere. But because it just sort of blew, and it seems like what it did is it probably pushed the line together and then popped it back apart. It is what it is. And I was definitely not driving slowly, which is actually not my tractor. But I was rocking and rolling with the buggy.
Yeah, they're making 40 foot passes.
Yep. So I was just cranking along and popping. So that is not actually our topic, though, for today's about how I destroyed the buggy, but is actually about really useful tools. So this topic came to me while we were baling hay and getting ready to bale hay. And we're using something that is maybe unexpected on the farm that is a really cool, I'm going to say tool is a loose term for what these are, but an item on the farm that is really useful, but not what you would expect to be really useful. So I will list my first one, then I'll let Josh list his first one. We have four. We were supposed to list three, but then we got excited. So each of us now has four items that we want to talk about today. My first one is a leaf blower, a gas-powered, high-powered leaf blower. I've always traditionally blown off equipment with compressed air, which is fine. It works. That works extremely well. The problem is you have to get to the compressed air, which usually means you're somewhere in like the driveway up near a garage or something like that, or a shop. And it's a pain in the butt to have all of that dust and dirt and blow off right outside of your barn, because then you have to blow off all the concrete there and everything else. So what we've started doing is blowing off the baler, fire-powered, gas-powered. This is a game changer. It's not only useful for that, but we also use it when we clean the barn. So when we get out all the hay from our hay barn, we will pick the big piles of hay up and put them in like a grapple bucket and take them and put them out in the where we need them, or a sinkhole or something like that. Just wherever organic matter is most useful at that point in time. But then there's a little bit of like stray small pieces of hay left. We'll let it sit for about a week, get dry, and then we'll just use the leaf blower and blow that hay out just to get more organic matter out of the barn so that we aren't continuously having to add rock to compensate for having a lot of hay and dirt build up in the barns. And it works great. We've used backpack blowers. They work great, but those are super powerful. Sometimes they blow the rock if you're not careful and it's not compacted down well. But just the general handheld, but the higher powered handheld leaf blowers, super useful. The majority of the dust and debris out of the baler, out of the compartments, out of the whole setup, right? Like everywhere that the rollers are, everywhere that the bearings sort of sit up at the top, you can kind of get all that little pieces of dust and debris out of there to give yourself a good grease point. And get yourself started. And I mean, you might want to do a better clean down right at the end of the season. In the middle of the year, there's no reason to be fully cleaning down your baler every time you run 10 or 15. Not practical. This you can do right there in the field. You can do wherever you are because it's a gas powered or even an electric one. I just would want a pretty powerful one. I don't want a really low cost yard one, but I want fairly decent this type of work. But it works great for that. Great for cleaning out a barn. Not what you would anticipate using a leaf blower for, but a really super handy tool that I didn't know we needed, but we desperately love having.
We use a little handheld electric blower, and that seems to work decent enough, for the most part if you're between days. But then, we actually used to always like wash the baler. Blow it off and wash it. That takes a lot of time and effort, and you can be more efficient. That's way more efficient. It does clean everything a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, just that little bit of extra power over some of the other options. And then the compressed air is really, but it's like a little nozzle. So you're constantly moving it all around.
Constantly redoing stuff, it seems.
Yep. Or you push it and then you move the dirt over a little bit and then you have to go back and cover that area again, whereas the blower is a much bigger open.
Yeah, you're covering painting with a broad brush as opposed to a fine.
Exactly. So leaf blower, number one on my list.
So number one on my list for most useful, one that we really say we love, is a staple gun. And so we use a staple gun. It's a battery power. We just had the fence in school the other day and we kind of talked about it a little bit, but the staple gun I really like the staple gun because it just saves you a lot of additional fatigue. And we used to have everybody and their brother out there, the entire family out there, going and putting nailing in staples just because it took so much time. Now it's only two of us out there and pretty much we just go through the line. As fast as you can count to nine, just about, I can be putting in staples.
That's so useful. I mean, that people who don't farm really don't appreciate like how your time.
Yes.
Every task that you do takes way longer than it should.
Yep.
And you're like, well, I only have to get these three things done today. That doesn't seem so bad. And then each task takes 1.5 hours on top of daily checks, which are on the list, but there all of a sudden you're your simple day has gone to 10 hours and how did that happen?
So, even to the next day.
Or yeah, or one of the three tasks that you thought were easy has to go to the next day. Exactly right. Or a cow gets out and then all three of the tasks go to the next day.
Yeah.
It is what it is. But yeah, that's, I'm with you. Like, I think that we haven't invested in one, yet I continue to think about it as like, maybe that's like,
And it's one of those things, it's a significant investment, but for us, you know, we say, you know, we're young enough, we want to be doing this a while, have it a while, so why don't we go ahead and get something that really just, and it does save a lot of time. You do, each battery probably gets us 300 foot. Using, you know, DeWalt has one, I think Walkie has one, there's some commercially ones available from Stockade
yeah.
that are really, really resilient, and so there are some good options, and we just found it, you know, the staples are going to be twice as expensive. So instead of being 4 cents, they're going to be about 8 cents per staple. But, you know, we had, man, we used the air. We, you know, we switched several years ago to the air one, but you just lose some of that flexibility.
Yeah, because then you have to have the air, pressed air out there with you. It means you have to charge it, which.
Pressed air, generator, gas, you know, you have, it's just additional stuff you have to take out there with you. And if you do have, we have a decent setup in the back of the Kawasaki, where we'd have the air compressor and the generator. But then, you know, you have to have that cord, enough cord to get you back and forth, and you're fighting with the cord to some degree. And that, whereas that one, I can just walk down, do whatever I need to do. Carry it. So we still, you know, carry a hammer for one or two here or there, and you can adjust the power, but yeah, it's a tool that just gives you a lot of flexibility and just saves you so much time. That's my number one. It's just a staple. And we got, like, a lot of fence looking at us this year. It seems like every year we got a lot of fence looking at us somehow. I keep thinking, when are we going to be done? and then we'll talk about, oh, we got this one. Oh, we got that one. It's like, okay, I just assume we're not going to be done.
That's probably a fair assessment. I'm kind of with you. My next one has to do with watering systems. And this is something that has surprised me how cool we that is sewer pipe.
Okay.
Sewer pipe is not exactly a tool, but it's certainly a useful item on the farm. It's generally a less expensive option out of the other tubing that we use. And so we use it for a couple. Have at a couple smaller tanks, fit more like an earth tube.
Okay.
Generally, we would use a double wall sort of corrugated pipe for this purpose.
Spendy.
But those are really spendy. And if I have a really big tank and a lot of water line and a lot of space, a lot of man, like I'm starting from scratch and I'm building it, I will probably go the wall to really build it. If I have an existing pad that's already there, I don't really want to break up the whole pad entirely if I don't. There's a good hard pan, there's a good rock layer already there. I'm just changing out tanks. Like we've done it where we've had a tank that is rusted out on the bottom or something like that, and we want to put in a plastic all water or something like that.
Yeah.
We can use a bigger piece of sewer pipe and just make sure we have a nice hole that good deep earth tube. And you use that.
Okay.
And that's pretty useful for that purpose. Other spot that we use, and this is really useful. Is we have moved to having a valve outside of every heavy use where there's a water tank.
Really?
So anywhere we put in a new water tank at this point, wherever we cut off from the water line, we will put a valve with a shut off.
Okay.
That means that we do not have to climb under a tank that is leaking when it's leaking to fix it. We can just go turn off with a ball valve or a gate valve back at the water line where it teeks off of the water line. We have a valve right there that does two things. It isolates that water tank. It also gives us a pretty good indication of where the main. So we'll move it off of the teak, so it's not right on the teak, but we'll only move it off by a foot or two. So if we had to get back to a main line, this also gives us an indication of where it is, and it's not in the rock path. That means the animals aren't going to spend a lot of time stepping on it. Ideally, we'll put it near fence line. There's a fence line there, like if we're putting fencing around that tank, so it's protected so that they don't step on it. But that sewer pipe, if I cut it at or just below dirt level and then I put a nice heavy metal plate on the top of it and let it sit down,
yeah,
it's below anything that would cut or weed eat. Okay. I can just weed eat right over the top of it. It's a nice round size. enough space to be able to get in there and turn that valve, but not so big.
You don't have unnecessary.
Yep, exactly. Space. And if I was to use like the same thing that I would traditionally use in an earth tube, that double walled pipe, it's a really big piece of pipe.
Yes.
And a narrow internal area. And then for me to put the plate over the top and cover that area becomes difficult too. I don't know why. I don't know who. I think it was one of the contractors had doing it for the valves, and it has been. I think that sewer pipe is not like the most perfect solution all the time, but it is a great option.
Or like in your fields, in your
For just where you want to have access to a water line, or even maybe even want access to a power line, and like that. This is a really good access point. That's not a break the back.
Yes.
So a really kind of a useful. Otherwise, you're trying to buy regular PV, double walled pipe, which is
expensive. And it's, that makes sense. I mean, and do you go past, like, do you sometimes go past your water and put another valve in just to connect in the future? Do you plan for that? Or
sometimes, usually I will tee off wherever I tee off to the water tank, that is, but I will run it out another couple hundred, probably another 10 or 15 feet past wherever that is, if it's the end of my line, so that I have line past where that tee happens, just so it doesn't dead end right there where the valve is, because I don't want to have to, if I want to run for water, I don't want to have to dig up where I just put a valve in the ground and I have everything down, everything cut flush and the way I want it. I don't want to have to come back in.
And figure it out.
Figure that.
Okay. It's my number two. I'm going to have it's going to seem like a lot of fencing related stuff, but it's really us important. Is our number two would be a rock auger.
Yeah.
And the rock auger just makes sense for us because, you know, we drive as many as we can. So a lot of times we'll go out there, put down the flags, and then we'll go ahead and try to start driving posts. And so there's been some lines where, you know, might be 100, and then other lines where we get to a point where we pretty much crest over a hill. We don't know what happened when we crest over that hill, but every post from the top all the way down the valley requires rock auger. And so a lot of times we just have to almost roll with the punches. But it's something where I had the guy came out there, or we, you know, brothers and I had him come out there and demo it. And I was like, well, he demo drilled a hole in the ground. I was like, okay, well, go out there. And it's like, I can't buy it off of just that. I was like, go out there and set on that rock. I was like, there was one of the big rocks at the surface there, and I knew he had his buddies underneath him. And I was like, just sit on that one and just do what you can with it. And he sat on there and drilled down, and, you know, then brought it right back up, and he was done. I was like, well, when can you get me one? You know, I saw at that point, I was like, you know, I just saw the value at that point. It was on the farm. We went through the rock that I had, and I was like, you know what? We just need one. You know, we hemmed and hauled for years. We knew that we're in part of Mercer County where it can be fairly rocky. And we're like, you know, that's just a nice tool to have for where we are.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point that there is a real value. I mean, your time is still so valuable. And at the end of the day, like, you have to be able to put a post in certain spots. There's a lot of flexibility with the high tensile wire and where you place posts, but that doesn't mean you don't need posts. Like,
yeah.
You have a hillside, you have to hit the top and bottom to get the fabric to run on the fence, on the topography of the ground, and where your corners and braces are, if you need to put gates in there,
yep.
Those spots are fixed. You don't have any option in there. So even if you're using a more flexible design material, it does not preclude the need to put posts in rock.
When we put up the hoop structure, even, I mean, we were putting that in and started out the first hole, dug just fine, not a rock that was hit, then every hole after that was a rock.
You had to use a rock.
And so before that, we had the spud bar, and that gets you so far.
Yep.
And then, you know, we were doing around a pond one time, and we realized that there was a lot more rock there than we anticipated, so we ended up getting a jackhammer. And that worked for a while, but, you know, you get out there, you're wrestling with a jackhammer, it's in a hole, it's not going to be the best of conditions.
Yeah, it's difficult to manhandle it when you're not stable, and it's not stable.
It's not stable, it's just awkward, and it's not a good, and we had electric jackhammer, so it did what it could, but at some point,
yeah.
You get the rock auger, you can just set it down, it just goes down, and we had, you know, at some point you use the 18-inch bit at some points, and you just let it go down. It takes a little longer, come back up, and that's it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, some of those take a little more time, but you just let it slowly grind away.
Yeah, I mean, I can't, I cannot, I'm lucky that we don't have as much rock where we are in Boyle, but occasionally we will hit a rock spot, and it is tremendous time sink.
Yes.
It's just so difficult to anticipate. And then, like, you go out there one day and you're like, I'm going to get all these posts in. I'm going to drive them all. It's going to be a good day. And then you hit a shelf of rock.
Yes.
And there you are 4 hours later with two posts in the ground.
Yeah.
And as the person who is not running the driver but is sitting in the skid steer as everyone else gets more and more frustrated, you...
You also get frustrated.
You also get frustrated, but you become like the brunt of all problems. So like as soon as there's a spot to drive, they're like, bah! You, and you're like, I didn't do anything. I literally have been sitting here in the skid steer because that is my job during this process. This is why fencing is so stressful in my marriage.
I guess, so you know. Yeah. You need a rock auger. Because we at some point, and we would try. And we tried to, you know, if we're on 20 foot, we'll go, okay, well, let's go 25, or let's go 15. We'll try to... You know, very like, oh, maybe that spot doesn't look as bad, or that, you know, if you see the rocks on the surface sometime, you're like, all right, he's got buddies. So, you know, you know that you're in a difficult, potentially difficult area.
Yep, I understand. So I think that's a good second one. I got a third one for you, though.
All right, let's hear it.
You have suggested these to me, and I think these might be a game changer. And they are tire caps that have pressure indicators in them.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
Yeah, so for anyone who doesn't know, they make caps that you can put on your tires where you air up your tires that will either do a 32 or a 35 PSI rating. So green if it's above that 32 or 35, goes to like a yellowy orange color as you go down for the next, I don't know if it's 2 or 4 PSI, somewhere like in that ballpark. And then below that, it goes to red.
Yep.
Excellent. Not great if you have 50 PSI implement tires. It's not quite as useful for them, although not bad even for them. But
Wow. But
for us, we have all these hay wagons that we use when we are in the hay field. I know you only have one hay hauler, but we have multiple wagons and multiple trucks. And my job is to always, my husband calls it herding the cats. I coordinate everything. While he's baling hay, my job is to get wagons and trucks back in the field. After the person raking is done, they will drop the rake. Usually they will then have a tractor with a loader out there, and they will start loading wagons. And then I take the hay off at the barns.
Yep.
And we're really, I know that a lot of people leave hay out in the field to let it breathe. Because of how we sell hay, we're pretty careful about how dry it is when we bale it, and then we're also pretty careful about bringing it into the barn immediately. Because having it rained on changes the color,
and
it changes the value of the hay. So ours comes in very fast. It is a key part of our process. We do it with family labor, which is cheap and frustrating.
Cheap, but costly in other ways.
It is emotionally costly some days to be in charge of the cats. So my job, though, is... that my husband's like, well, you just have to check the tire pressure in all of these and then grease fittings on this and that and the other thing, but while I'm baling hay. And sometimes he's only baling hay for three hours or so, and I have a lot to manage in that three-hour window that he doesn't think takes very long, but it does take a long time for me to do all of this. If I have to go around and get every hay wagon, check every tire, then I have to bring it to the air compressor. I just said before the air compressor is at the barn. I can use the pancake, but it's a pain in the butt if I have a lot of tires. And I have a lot of tires because I have 4 or 5 wagons going back.
Yep.
So if I have these pressure caps on and I can walk around and see green on all 4, I can ship that whole wagon back, and I don't have to undo each cap, use my pressure gauge, check and confirm each one each time. First time in the season, I will always go in and check these. I'll also go in and make sure that any bearing that could take grease has grease in it, that they've been repacked in a recent amount of time. These wagons do take a huge amount of load. I want a good visual inspection at the beginning of the year. But then after that, some people will say, oh, I just give them a quick kick and check to make sure they're loaded, which is fine, in my opinion, if you are just hauling hay on your own farm in your own farm.
Yes.
But when you're hauling down the road, that is probably not the right decision, just from a liability standpoint. The last thing you want to do is, and I have done it, is blow a tire on the road and not be able to get back and then have a load of hay sitting there in the field, and then you have to jack it up and change out a tire in the road with the crazies that are on the road that don't believe in stopping.
With hay, and it's
a fully loaded wagon. That's a heavy wagon to try and jack up.
Yeah.
And it's hard to stop a wagon on the road. You know, the trucks are pretty good at pulling them, but they're not particularly efficient at stopping them because there's no brake on that wagon. That's a lot of weight that we're asking the truck to try and manage.
And if they do blow out, sometimes they kick the bales off.
They can. You can throw bales very easily. Yeah. And I mean, yeah, it's just, there's a lot of liabilities. So you want to make sure your tires are good quality, do the good visual inspection at the beginning of the year. But if I have to do it every time we go out in the field, which is like 4 or 5 times each cutting, I need to move these hay wagons around. I have hours and hours committed to checking tire pressures. I mean, on top of doing tire pressure checks on the front tractor tires, doing tire pressure checks on other implements that I'm hauling, like the Bush Hog and things like that. I have lots of things where I'm checking tire pressure. And if I can just get a few of these things off of my plate.
It's definitely a relief.
It is a huge relief, and it makes the whole process so much smoother for me, because that way when people are like, I'm ready to go, I can say, this wagon is good to go. You may take it. Instead of, you have to wait for me, when they don't like that answer. So I don't mind being the bad guy, but those tire pressures, indicators on those caps are really useful in hay season.
I mean, we even put them on, like, because some of them go up to 80 PSI. We put them on the cattle trailer.
That is a great point. Yeah, cattle trailers are another one that you don't want to be messing around with having incorrect.
Yeah.
It's harder to find them, though. If you are like looking and searching on Amazon, the 32, 35 are really easy to find. I saw a few that were 50. I haven't seen an 80 yet, but I will go back and search for some, because we have some 80 PSI.
Even I think we found up to 110, the one that hauls our skid steer, and it goes up to 110 on some of those tires. And so we did find a couple of those that go up to 110, and it is really good, because if I can walk around that and see, okay, these two are an issue, then come back the next time and say, fill them up, and then come back around and see, okay, these two are an issue again. So I know which ones to kind of really monitor and watch as well. So it's really a good, quick indicator of, go, no go, almost go, no go scenario.
Perfect.
So, but anyway, I'm going to talk about my third one, which is, again, a little different, but related to all the other ones I have. So somehow they're all kind of related to fencing to some degree, or this one's loosely related to fencing, but it can be utilized, a tree puller for the skid steer.
Oh, yeah.
So the tree puller for the skid steer, where it makes a lot of sense is, so we're clearing some ground, so small trees, you can sometimes send it through a bush hog, and we've torn up a number of collars and shafts and so on. When we get a tree puller? So a tree puller, and it's fairly effective. We kind of rock back and forth the skid steer, use the weight of it to help us pull these out. And it's a slow process, but I was like, we're not going to go gangbuster here, but we don't have a lot of huge trees. We just have enough to be a pain.
Right.
And so we're just using that tree puller. And it's, typical kind of like little triangle comes in and grapples a tree, and then you pull it up and out. And so then we've also found use for it with, pulling T-posts. A quick and easy way to pull T-posts, quick, easy way to pull posts.
Yeah.
And, regular fence posts.
Yeah. And I'll say this, we use a chain still. We don't have one. You made me think about this. But from a safety perspective, using a chain and wrapping a chain to pull posts, and even some trees that don't have a lot of limbs on them, can be pretty dangerous, because they can slide pretty easily, that chain can.
Yeah.
And you don't know exactly what's going to happen when you lift with that chain. There's not a lot of control over what's going to happen with whatever you're pulling out of the ground.
Right.
I've never hurt myself doing it. I should probably knock on wood when I when I say that, because it'll probably happen next time we have to do one. But that it is a little bit of a safety risk. Like, you have to recognize that when you're pulling things with like a chain and trying to wrap it.
Yeah.
You are taking an inherent risk in that decision to do it that way.
Yeah, really, we've seen them all slide up, all those posts, because, let's frictional get it, the chain angle pull, we're relying on a lot of factors where we could just have something go in there, put hydraulic pressure on there, and lift it up and out. And it's just, for us, you know, clean out all the wire, then you go in there with the skid steer, it makes quick work of it. And so that's, I guess for us, it's about, you know, those little time savers, so stuff we have. And so it's a staple gun, it's the rock auger, it's this to help us get just a little bit faster through these processes and make it, you know. And so then it goes from a two-man job, potentially a one-man job.
Yeah, absolutely. Makes complete sense. That's a great idea.
So it's about reducing labor, reducing the amount of labor, just reducing time for us.
I'm with you. I mean, I don't think we thought this was going to be all labor savings, but really unexpectedly useful items almost always are a time saver. Like, that's probably a time and energy saver for us.
Yes.
And I think for most farmers, they need to figure out how to do some of these same things to save some time and energy. So hopefully this inspires someone. My fourth one here, this is maybe not going to shock anyone here, but zip ties.
Yeah.
I mean, and most people think of zip ties as attaching things together or bundling something. And I do use them for that. We actually use zip ties anytime we put up a reel or something, or an electric extension cord or things like that. Yeah, those are, and that's, I would consider that more standard uses of a zip tie that most people would think of. But where they're really useful on a farm is we use them as indicators on our hydraulics.
So color coding. So
color coded, or if we don't even have colors, some of them we actually have single and double clear, just regular white or black lines. My husband likes on the rear remotes, he likes a single on the top and a double on the bottom.
Okay.
That's his preference, that everything on the rear remote is a single double. Anything that hooks up into a front loader, which is a more substantial set of that, that's all colored. Okay. So all of our remotes there are color coded on both sides so that we can hook them together and pretty efficiently. The other option, the one thing we have bought recently is there's special tape or wrap that you can use on your hydraulics that are color coded, really nice for keeping lines sort of together and out of the way. But you can also use that type of wrap, or some people will use electrical tape, but I find that electrical tape is harder to hold on to those hydraulics long term.
Yeah.
The zip ties don't tend to go anywhere, which is good. This specialized tape that we actually bought some after Farm Machinery Show. It's really useful for this too, but this is one of those things that, like, you know, it's useful, but then, like, you're using it on the farm and you're like, the color coding, the number of wire, the number of wraps, the number of all of that identification. Yes. The zip ties is surprisingly useful.
And it's another method to streamline hooking up equipment.
Yeah, it streamlines it, and it's pretty easy if something goes wrong to cut it and replace it very cheaply.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, buying the tapes and some of those other things are pretty costly solutions, this is a very inexpensive solution. Now, you have to understand the notation that's being used. So,
yes,
it's not good for someone who, the color coding is usually pretty instinctive. The number of wires that we use on our rear remotes is very much my husband's preference. That's, I know it, so I can follow it. But it doesn't mean that someone who comes in blindly will know what's happening exactly. Although, if you want to give me a comment and tell me that you also use this system, that would make my day. So feel free to.
And we started with ours. You know, ours started with the baler because you had four cords to connect, and somehow we'd always get it wrong. Yeah. And so, or you'd have to go back and fiddle, and it's another job was easy kind of with two people. So I'll try that one. Okay, hang on, let me.
Yeah.
And so once we figured out, we used the color coding method. And so once we had that color coded, we figured out for one tractor, and then pretty much everything else is just built off of that kind of color coded system. Hooked the baler to the other tractor, figured out whichever ones work for it, color coded those same, both input and output for it. And so we color coded both and pretty much started with the baler and went from there.
Yeah. And the other spot that I have a note on here is for possibly doing some fencing type work. Not to attach your fencing to your post directly, at least not in like a good fencing design. That's not a good option. Sometimes it's a good option if like something has fallen and popped off and you don't have steeples with you to just hold it up there until you come back to repair it. But also on water gaps, or any spot that you need to add a little bit of extra space,
And people will sometimes do it, and I use it sometimes, like a hog panel or a cattle panel, and you want to just attach it to the bottom of like a woven wire type of fencing, not necessarily for the electric fencing, but for a woven wire fencing, you can just zip tie that on there, and then it can swing. That's not a bad option. Honestly, I like it better sometimes than using wire to tie it on. Because it doesn't seem, sometimes when you use wire, you end up with wire that is not as good a quality that you use because it's easier to tie it, and then it rusts, and then you have degradation of both your fence and
your panel.
That panel, and that's not what you want. So if you can use a zip tie and let it swing, but keep it tight enough that it's attached in a bunch of spots, that's a great way to.
That's a great, yeah, for the goat. Man, we use that similar system for the goats, and it works fairly well in the little, just little spots where it's low spots, you know, not enough for a cow to get through, but enough for a goat. And you put a little piece of panel there, cut off a section of panel, put it there, it works great.
Yeah.
So I concur.
Yeah, I've even used it on a, like I have a composting thing, and I have just a piece of panel that I've wrapped to put my compost in out of my house. And I didn't really want to use anything else to tie it together, but I wanted to make sort of like a round area that could aerate. And I use zip ties on it because they don't break down, even under some conditions that might cause some degradation on some other materials. The zip ties are just pretty resilient.
So, I mean,
little useful things just for all kinds of things.
Then my fourth one is, so it's a little different. It doesn't actually apply to the fence, but having a good impact. A good impact gun, something where we take a lot of, maybe not heavy equipment, but a lot of the equipment apart easier. So at least getting our bolts loosened. You know, some of those I still like to tighten it up to, you know, a lower level where I can get it and then take it there from there with a torque wrench or something. But I use it just to quickly and easy get some nuts and bolts broken loose. And you know, some of those, you know, we have to sit on there for a good little bit to get that broken loose. And we have a 4-foot cheater bar. We have, you know, some stuff to take things apart. But having a good impact can make a huge difference in conducting maintenance, or if you have to do a big major repair usually. Yeah. That'd be where it comes in really handy.
Yeah, and there are lags in all kinds of things that maybe don't exist in a lot of other facets of life, but on farms there's like lags in all sorts of pieces and structures and things. And you're just like, what am I doing here? So an impact really helps with that kind of stuff. I will say that you have an impact that is plug-in, that is, it goes into a 110 volt circuit, and then there are our battery ones. The battery ones I love from a accessibility standpoint, but I have yet to find one that I think has an excellent lifespan on the battery. They just chew through batteries so quickly. So you're playing this sort of game with these impacts of like, I want both. I actually want both. I want an electric one that'll plug into the wall, and then I want a battery powered one that I can use off of a,
on the farm, I'm in the field, I'm taking stuff apart.
Yeah, so like if I have one or two that I have to do, I want to be able to go out there without any cord, but I want to have something else that if I knew I'm doing a major project, I can use that plug-in impact. Because they're more powerful. They just are more powerful. They last longer under pretty heavy
conditions, yeah.
Usage, yeah. And two, the batteries just don't hold up particularly well, in my experience. Maybe someone would like to come in and correct me. I would be happy to.
And I will say this: I have a red and black impact, but it's a the battery powered one. And you know, they have a 5-year warranty apparently. And I took it in and said, "Hey, this one has stopped working in essence." So I was able to go through the warranty claim with it, and I was surprised. It went through and came back like, "What do I owe? Nothing." And
that's
so
a good sign,
I'm surprised. So some of those, you know, it's worth checking and seeing if those batteries, you know, if they do have a warranty of some sort, how long do they stand behind that product? And some will stand by it pretty good. You know, others might, you know, just it's worth checking and seeing.
Yeah, and I've actually had to warranty out an impact too. So I guess what we're saying is we use our impact quite regularly on the farm. I will say that we never use an impact to put like a tire together or to put a bolt in somewhere, like in a piece of equipment, or it just is not something that we do. There are torque specifications on a lot of these things for a reason.
Yep.
Taking something off, on the other hand, very useful. Although I will say that I just recently had some damage done to my car. Someone took something off with an impact, and then the process managed to break a plastic piece on a So you have to be cognizant of what you're doing when you're using an impact, but there are a lot of spots where because of the exposure to elements and things get very tight. Nuts and bolts get very tight, and using an impact can be a huge game changer in getting those things broken apart.
Because a lot of times we always jokingly called it that it rust welded together.
It rust welded. Well, that's not an inaccurate descriptor of how that works sometimes.
So sometimes this implement that's been out maybe outside for a while, it'll be hard use or, you know, gotten some mud in there. So sometimes they do become very, very resilient or against coming apart. So you have to almost have an impact to really break it loose.
Yeah. I think that's fair. But you're right. That is a very useful tool that most people don't think of. I think people think using an impact to put stuff together, not necessarily to take stuff apart. So
it's mainly for us to take apart, then correctly put it together. I mean, sometimes put a nut on, you get a nut driven down onto the threads, and then you try to take the rest of the way.
Yeah.
It's my philosophy.
I think that's a fair point. I think that's a pretty good summary. I think we now have probably spent more time than we meant to talking about all of these fun and useful items on our farms. If anyone has a comment for us, I think we'd be really curious to see what people else they think is really useful that they unexpectedly useful on their farms.
Unexpectedly useful, yeah. What, you know, we've had a couple ideas, and I think there's a lot more potential. You know, press can be helpful. There's a lot of other aspects that are helpful on a farm.
Yeah. So let's, before we jump off here, just give one or two quick goals for next week on the farm.
One or two quick goals. Really, you know, looking at all that fence we got ahead of us and probably thinking about that, maybe potentially fertilizing some, spreading more manure. And we ran some calves off to the yards this past week trying to see how they sold.
Yeah, we have not, but we are actually thinking about putting our calves that we were going to sell here in early May. We're thinking about putting them out on some grass to eat some grass that we have. We got to move a couple animals around. We still have about a month before we're even looking at breeding our cows. But trying to get everything organized into the groups we went for breeding season. We did do our fall pregnancy check, so maybe we'll come back next week and do an update on that stuff.
Okay.
But just getting groups reorganized, making sure we know what we're selling, making sure we get the right vaccines for the right number of animals for the right locations is sort of on our list.
All right. That makes a lot of sense.
And we will see you guys with another podcast here shortly.
Take care.
Have You Heard is a production of the University of Kentucky College of Agriculture, Food and Environment, along with the Department of Biosystems and Agricultural Engineering. Discover what's wildly possible at ca.uky.edu.